may wonder where to get hold of some of this material. Some of you may have a lot of it right under your nose, and you may not realize it. Most all of you, I guess, have encyclopedias. If you have the World Book, and I presume it's in all the others. We used to have some more. We gave those away to the girls, and I think the last set we got is going to go to somebody. But I did find some of the material in the World Book. If you run down the Reformation, and then such fellows as Calvin and men of that nature, Luther, you would find that part of material. Then in old ancient history books, if you have some of those laying around, you'd just be surprised when you get in there and begin to read it. You might not have enjoyed it too much when you were studying it sometime, but there's a lot of sources that you can go to find a lot of this early history, and you'd just be surprised. What really surprises me, how the world can study this kind of material, and it's in history books, and not recognize the folly of Catholicism and denominationalism and things of this nature. Now, as we started out, the scope of our study, we pointed out the first thing we wanted to do was get a clear conception of the New Testament church as it's revealed in the New Testament. And that was our first lesson. Then we pointed out, secondly, we wanted to consider the departure from the faith and look at it as it resulted in the formation of the Roman Catholic Church. And that's what we did last week. We pointed out that when you look at the church in the New Testament, the organization was a plurality of elders in every congregation, and these congregations were independent and self-governing. But when you get into the second century, you see a departure from this government. You see they would elect one elder to be the bishop, and they begin to make a distinction in the terms as they're used in the New Testament. An elder and a bishop are one and the same in the New Testament, but they began to make a distinction. A bishop was a little higher than the elders, and then elders in a town would be more important than elders in the country. And so the bishop in town, he would not only control the town church and the elders under him, but when they'd go out and establish a congregation in the country, they would also have dominion over the country church. And it wasn't long, of course, until these bishops began to mass great territories with churches under them. And then it finally wound up, of course, that there were five leading bishops, and the bishop of Rome and the bishop of Constantinople and the bishop of Jerusalem and the bishop of Antioch. And these then began in Alexandria, Egypt, and that names the five. They began to divide with one another. They, of course, were called patriarchs. And finally, it boiled down to two of them who really got into it in 588 A.D., the patriarch of Constantinople. His name was John the Faster, and he assumed the title of universal bishop of the church. And, of course, this brought on a very bitter struggle, but by 606 A.D., the emperor took the title of universal bishop away from John the Faster, and he conferred it upon Boniface III. And this, of course, then completed the organization of the Roman Catholic Church. Then we saw the false doctrines that came in, and we saw under Constantine, emperors then began to have control, leaders of nations in the church. And so for about 500 years, emperors had a lot of control. But the last 500 years, beginning with about 1054 A.D., The popes, they succeeded in wrestling the power now from rulers, and for about 500 years then the church, the Roman Catholic Church and the popes, they were dominant. And rulers did just about what popes wanted them to do. Now, we come to the 16th century, and of course before that we'll look at some material. We see what we call the Reformation movement. In other words, the Roman Catholic Church was losing its power. People were sick of its corruption. Even priests, and many of these reformers were priests, they were sick and tired of what they were seeing, and we see a revolt against the Catholic Church. And this is what we call the Reformation period. Now, these men started out to try to reform the Catholic Church. They really didn't start out to start denominations, but that was the ultimate end. So first, as we look at the Reformation, we need to look at the background of the Reformation movement, why it came about. Now, as we start out, we'll point out first, as we've already somewhat stated, for more than 1,000 years now, the Catholic Church had held supreme position in the world and in the lives of people. This is what we call the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages. And it's really the Dark Ages, because when the Roman Catholic Church dominated, they just stopped the movement of the world intellectually, from the standpoint of progress industrial-wise. It was just a bad time in the world when they reigned. And that's what you and I need to recognize, that they still have in their hearts these same kind of attitudes to dominate wherever they can. And they do it. They do it in this state. When I first moved to this state in 55, I saw the power of the Roman Catholic Church down in Lebanon. And you can ask Harvey and Ann. They were raised up around there. The kind of political clout the Roman Catholic Church has in Marion County, Kentucky, and no doubt other counties, but probably more so in Marion County than really any place in the state. Well, that's the kind of power they lack. And whenever they have opportunity to exercise this power, they'll do it. And you'd better not believe the big lie that the time has come that we could have a Roman Catholic president. We've had one, but that it doesn't make any difference. It will make a difference whenever when these men are in political power and have time to exercise it, because their beliefs is that the church ought to be dominant, and the state, of course, ought to kneel down under their power. And so that's what we see happening for the first 1,000 years after the falling away. They were in a supreme position of power. And it affected the culture of the people. It was the framework that united various states in Western Europe. And at the very height of the Catholic Church power, we would say that was probably under Pope Innocent III. There wasn't anything innocent about him, but who reigned from 1198 to 1216, and all European rulers, they accepted the Pope's spiritual and temporal sovereignty. In other words, whatever he said went. He just got his way. And that was at the very zenith of the power. But now, in the course of the 1300s and 1400s, the Catholic Church began to fall from its position of universal power. There was struggle now on the part of popes with rulers. And then there was a lot of corruption now, had entered into the hierarchy and to the priests, and this was all weakening the Catholic Church. The public was indignant, and they were outraged at the abuses now that had crept into the administration of the organization of the Roman Catholic Church. And when they could see the great decline in the morals of the priests and the monks and the popes that were elected. Now, the rule of celibacy for popes, for priests and popes too, and bishops and all of them, this, of course, was contrary to God's law concerning marriage. Because as we've been studying marriage here on Sunday morning, and you're well familiar with what the Bible teaches, when God created man, he said it was not good for man to be alone. And Paul, of course, pointed out in 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 5, that God intended marriage to fulfill the sexual needs of man. And so the rule of celibacy was contrary to God's law and against the natural instincts of man. And so many priests became immoral. They gave themselves over to illicit unions, and these unions often produced children. A number of popes were known for their immorality. Pope Innocent VIII, he reigned from 1484 to 1492, and he had illegitimate children. He had seven or eight sons by different women. And then after him, there was Pope Alexander the VI. He reigned from 1492 to 1503, and he had eight illegitimate children by different women, and he had four children by one woman. And when he became pope, he brought these children with him to Rome. Now, can you imagine an organization that teaches celibacy and holds up itself as the leader of the people morally? And here is a pope that lives such an ungodly life. This gives you some idea of the outrage that was found in the hearts of the common man. But all of this, of course, was laying the groundwork to overthrow the power of the Roman Catholic Church. Then nationalism was on the rise. Now, during the Middle Ages, the kingdoms of Europe were not really nations. They had shifting boundaries and constant civil wars. But now a new force of nationalism was gradually spreading throughout the world. In other words, rulers were trying to build strong national governments. And they became very jealous of the power that these popes exercised. And so these rulers wanted, civil rulers, they wanted to gain absolute sovereignty over the nations that they ruled for themselves. And so the first real conflict came with Boniface the VIII from 1294 to 1303. This was when their power began to slip. Boniface, he was unable to compel the ruler of England and the ruler of France to bow down before his commands. And then after the death of Boniface the VIII, a French archbishop was chosen to be pope, and he took the title of Clement the fourth, and he did then what Philip the fifth the ruler of France wanted him to do. Well, what Philip wanted him to do, he wanted Clement to take up residence in France. And I presume you pronounce this Avignon. I'll spell it, A-V-I-N-G-N-O-N. And so this is where he moved the capital from Rome to France. Now this was weakening now the Roman Catholic Church. And of course this put the Pope or made him subject to French influence. Now, instead of the influence of Rome. Now from 1309 to 1376, the popes, they remained in Avignon, France. And so, you see, the capital now of the Roman Catholic Church is not in Rome, but in France. Well, do you think the rest of the world liked that? They most certainly did not. And you can see that now the popes are beginning to lose their prestige, because now here is a civil ruler that has enough power to force a pope to live where he wants him to live. And now this period has been called the Babylonian captivity of the Catholic Church. And as I've stated, during this period, they lost a lot of their prestige and they lost a lot of power. Now, after this, when Pope Gregory the 11th came to be Pope, he moved the capital back to Rome in 1377. Now, he died the following year. And, of course, the multitude of people in Rome, they demanded now that an Italian pope be elected. And they wanted the power, you see. And so Urbain the Sixth was elected, and the French cardinals, they maintained that the election was invalid because of outside pressure on the voters. So they would have no part of it. They simply went back to France, to Avignon, and they elected them a pope, Clement the Seventh. Now you got two popes trying to reign over the Roman Catholic Church. But what you see now, the Roman Catholic Church now is being weakened. Now, these two popes both claim universal sovereignty, and they both excommunicated one another and didn't recognize each other. And this, of course, divided the nations of Europe. Part of the nations of Europe, and history would bear out which part, went with the Pope of France, and the other, they gave their allegiance to the Pope of Rome, and both of them set themselves up a college of cardinals. And in 1395, the doctors of theology in the University of Paris, and incidentally, this would be considered at this time the chief theological school at that period of time, they suggested that if the two popes would not resign, then a general council of all the church should be held and elect another pope. So they wouldn't resign. So they wouldn't give up their office. So in 1409, a majority of the cardinals on both sides, they met in the council of Pisa, I guess is the way you pronounce it, P-I-S-A, and put the popes out of office, both of them now. They put them out of office, and they elect a third pope. Now, do you think that these two fellows that have been declaring themselves popes were going to give up? No. Now the Roman Catholic Church has three popes trying to reign at one time. But what we're trying to get you to see with this background, you see the power now of the Roman Catholic Church is crumbling through their own infighting and through rulers now, civil rulers who are tired of being dominated by these popes, and they're trying now to take it back in hand. Now, this all ended, the fight between all of these popes, this all ended in 1417 with the election of Martin V. Now, at this period of time, we see then a revival in learning. As we pointed out, during the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, nobody got an education but the nobles and the churchmen and the priests and bishops and folks like that, and folks who had money and held the land and the power. And the majority of folks, of course, were just about like slaves in this period of time. And so we see that learning had come to a standstill, but now we see a revival in learning. We have what's known as the Renaissance, and the Renaissance put great stress upon individualism. This came about in about the 1500s, about as the 1500s come in, we see the Renaissance period. Now, universities began to be built all over Europe, and students began to flock to these schools that were being built and crowded into the cities. And at this time, there was the rise of humanism. Now, we hear a lot about humanism today. That's not something new. Humanism is as old as man. But with humanism, of course, was the here and now, the people who wanted to live here and now. So there was a lot of humanism or skepticism. And, of course, all of this, and their emphasis, of course, was upon individualism. And do your own thing, sort of like folks are today, you see. And as I say, they were not interested in the world to come, spiritual things. The humanist, he is simply interested in what goes on now. But all of this had its effect in crumbling the power of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, at this period of time, there was growth in commerce. And when this began to grow, then you had the rise of a new middle class. Before, you didn't have a middle class. You only had the churchmen and the nobles. And now, in the rise of commerce, you have a middle class. Well, now, this middle class, they are discontent. They are mad, you might say, at the Roman Catholic Church, because the Roman Catholic Church has been the main obstacle in their way to keep them from rising to power, you see. Now they've got a taste of some of the good things of life, and as they begin to look, they know why they had, or their forefathers didn't have a chance at this. It was the Roman Catholic Church. And so you see, the Roman Catholic Church now, they are gathering a lot of enemies, both politically and socially and every other way. Folks are tired of this domination. Then, along in this period of time, we have the invention of the printing press. And that means now that you can see there was the rise in learning, the starting of schools and universities. Now books could be printed and be distributed, and the society becoming educated and coming out of ignorance. And all of this, of course, is not in favor of Catholicism. Catholicism has a hard time surviving where there is learning and freedom and things of this nature. That's the reason they have a lot of problems in America. You know, the American Catholic, he gives a lot of flack to the hierarchy over in Rome. And it's because of the freedom that's in this country. But we see now freedom was coming about. Now, there came a man on the scene by the name of John Wycliffe in 1324 to 1384, and he's been called the morning star of the Reformation. He was an Englishman, and he was born in about 1324. He was educated in Oxford. He was ordained a priest, and he was a professor in Oxford. And for a while in the early part of his life, he rose to great positions. He didn't rock the boat. But he then began to study and began to see the corruption, and he began to assail then the Roman Catholic Church. He repudiated the papal headship, or in other words, the Pope ruling everything, and he repudiated the corruption that he saw, and he said all of this was a corruption of the primitive church, as it's found, of course, on the pages of the New Testament. He denied transubstantiation. Of course, that's the doctrine of the Roman Catholics concerning the Lord's Supper. Of course, they say that the fruit of the vine is transformed into the literal blood, and the unleavened bread becomes the literal flesh. Well, John Wycliffe, he rejected, you see, the papal authority. He rejected and denied transubstantiation. He emphasized the saving power of Christ was independent of the priestly mediation. The man didn't need the priest. All he needed was the Lord. He taught the authority of the Scriptures. And he of course, de-emphasized and pointed out, of course, the lack of authority of the Roman Catholic Church. He put great emphasis upon the on scriptural authority. Now, he appealed, even though he was an educated man and an educator, the people he appealed to were the common folks in town and in the country. And he was the first to translate the whole Bible into the English language. And, of course, this was also another thing to help break the power of the Catholic Church. It was made from the Latin Vulgate. In other words, it was translated from the original tongue, Hebrew and Greek. But he took an old Latin translation and translated and made an English version from the Latin. And so it took about 10 months to write out a copy of this Bible. And so you can see just how precious the Word of God was to people in that time. Now, he died in about, in 1384. And after he died, 40 years after he died, the Roman Catholic Church, they were so angry with him that they dug up his bones and they then burned them and they scattered the ashes over the River Swift. That's just how mean they were. And then there was another fella that came on the scene by the name of John Huss from, let's see, I guess about, my last number was, I guess this is when he died, it was about 1415, I didn't remember. But he lived in Bohemia. He was a priest. He became a disciple of Wycliffe, and that's the fellow I just got through describing. He exalted the Scriptures above tradition. He denounced the sale of indulgences. And he was summoned to the Council of Constance, and he was tried as a heretic. And he was burned to death by the Roman Catholic Church in July of 1415. Now, his disciples, of course, they didn't give up, and they kept alive the things that he stood for. And what I want you to see in all of this background, you see, the Catholic Church is into it from the standpoint of having its domination and power. It's made too many enemies. Too many men now are beginning to stand against it. And with Wycliffe and Huss, they of course made their influence was greatly felt. And then we come to what we would call the Reformation proper. And this starts now with Martin Luther. Now, Luther was born November the 10th, 1483 in Germany. He was a German. He was given an education, a good education, a university education. He received his first degree in 1503. 2 years later, he received his doctors of philosophy. And by 1505, he had become a monk. And in 1507, he was ordained a priest. Now, he became a professor of theology in the University of Wittenberg, Germany. Now, in 1510, he visited the court of Pope Leo the X at Rome. And here he saw all of the irreverence and the corruption and the ungodliness of the priests and the monks. And this, of course, was very disillusioning to Luther when he saw the corruption that prevailed in Rome. And he lost his reverence for the sanctity of the Pope on this visit. And so Pope Leo the X wanted now to complete the Cathedral of St. Peter in Rome. And, of course, it's going to take a lot of money to complete this. It's a very costly project, and they didn't have the money. So the Pope sent out agents to sell indulgences as a means of raising money. And, of course, an indulgence was a piece of paper, or we might call it a letter, which could be used like money to buy the forgiveness of sins. That shows you the kind of corruption. And sometimes the sins, of course, had already been committed when a fellow would buy his indulgence. He'd buy that for sins he'd already committed. And sometimes he would buy an indulgence for sins which he intended to commit in the future. So it was a lucrative thing, you see. And there was a priest by the name of Tetzel, or T-E-T-Z-E-L, and of course he was really good at selling these indulgences. He was sort of a ruthless type fella that didn't have any character. He was out raising the money. And so he would go in a community and he would exhort the people to give liberally for themselves and for their dead relatives in purgatory who was crying out to them for help. And so, you know, that would touch ignorant people who were all caught up in this. And all they were trying to do, of course, was rip the people off, as we'd say today, to get the money to finish this Cathedral of St. Peter in Rome. And so Luther, he became very angry at what he saw going on. And so he began to question the validity of this whole system of indulgences that had been going on for years, of course, at the Roman Catholic Church. And so Luther, he challenged Tetzel to a debate in October 15, in October of 1517, and he nailed 95 propositions on the subject of indulgences on the door of the church building in Wittenberg, Germany. Now, the 95 propositions naturally would be condemned by the Roman Catholic Church as heresy. And, of course, they burned them. And this would be what we would mark as the real beginning of the break with Rome. Now, in 1519, Luther, he debated a theologian by the name of Eck, E-C-K, and in this debate, Luther denied the Pope's supremacy. He also took the position that a man could possess a direct relationship with God without the need of the church's mediation. Now, this was the same view that Huss had been burned for by the Council of Constance. Now, Luther now found himself with his religious positions far removed from the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. So you can see by 1520, he separated himself completely when he published three pamphlets against the Roman Catholic Church. The first one was an address to the nobles of the German nation. And in this address, he maintained that the priesthood was not sacred and that the nobles should free Germany from Roman control and take over the wealth and the land from the church for themselves. And you can see the Roman Catholic Church wouldn't like that. His second pamphlet was on the Babylonian captivity. He attacked both the papacy and the sacramental system. And then his third pamphlet was on the freedom of a Christian man. In other words, he set forth his new views on salvation, faith only. And we have to contend with that today. Faith only came from Luther. And of course, that was the very opposite, because the Roman Catholic Church, they put great emphasis on words. Not works of faith, as the New Testament teaches, but on just works and penance and things of this nature. So he swung to the other extreme, and he wrote a pamphlet on justification by faith only. Now you can see that these three things would really separate him now from the Catholic Church. So in June of 1520, the Pope issued a bull that gave Luther 60 days to cease his course of action. If he hadn't ended his course of action in this period of time and hadn't confessed his errors, he would then be cut off from the Roman Catholic Church and handed over to the secular authorities to be punished. In December of 1520, Luther, he defied him. He publicly burned the bull, and it was among students and townspeople, and when he did it, they applauded. So you see that the revolt now is on, and you see Luther now has found himself in the position of a religious leader, and you could say also a political leader. And I might point out that in this period of time, you see the humanists and all of these folks who had just give up on religion, but they saw a way out under Luther. And so he had the backing of all of these people throughout Germany and Europe. And so on January the 3rd, 1521, Leo the 10th, he issued then a bull of excommunication. And 4 months later, the Diet of the Holy Roman Empire declared Luther an outlaw. Now, of course, he was into it. He had to go into hiding. He was given protection by a friend by the name of Frederick, and he let him hide in his castle. It was during this period of time that he translated the New Testament into the German language, and he put it into the common lingo of the people. But the sad part about that translation, of course, he taught his doctrine of faith only. He entered that in, and he thought, of course, Luther thought the book of James was a straw man. And you can see why he would think that when you read James 2 and verse 24. That didn't fit his doctrine. Luther now, in the beginning, did not start out to sever his connection with the Roman Catholic Church. He was simply trying to reform it. Now, his work finally resulted in the formation of the Lutheran Church, an institution, of course, that did not exist prior to Luther. And it's amazing how people could be a member of that and think they were a member of the Lord's Church. The Reformation then in Switzerland. The reform in Switzerland is generally attributed to two great leaders, Zwingli and John Calvin. Zwingli was born in January 1st, 1484, 7 weeks after Luther was born. So you can see they were contemporaries. In 1506, he was ordained a priest. Zwingli, like Luther, he visited Rome, and when he saw, as Luther did, he saw all of the evils and all of the errors and all the corruption of the Roman Catholic Church. He saw that there was, it was necessary, rather, that a reform come about. And so in the year 1516, Zwingli This was his own ideas. I took this out of the book. In the year 1516, Zwingli has noted as the period of the commencement of the Swiss Reform. And so I take that whoever was writing that history had taken that from Zwingli. That was the year he had established himself for the Swiss or the Switzerland Reform, 1516. Now, in 1522, the court of Rome began action against the Reformation in Switzerland. The Catholic Church tried to stop Zwingli's preaching. And not long after the Reformation was publicly established in Zulrich, pictures were taken down out of the church building, and statues were removed. All of this showing that a reform was coming about. And instead of the Mass, and of course the Catholics, when they talk about the Mass, they've completely changed what the Bible teaches. They don't look on the Lord's Supper as a memorial. It's a sacrifice to the Catholics. And so Zwingli, of course, had changed it from the Mass to a simple form of the Lord's Supper. And the difference in the doctrine of Zwingli and Luther was this. Luther, he taught, and now you listen to this because this makes a great impact in the religious world. Luther taught that any religious practice was permissible if God did not specifically forbid it in the Bible. Now listen to Zwingli. Zwingli held the position you and I hold. Zwingli taught one could not participate in any religious act unless the Bible positively authorized it. That's exactly where we stand. And you can see why Zwingli could never go along with Luther. Just like you and I couldn't go along with the Baptists or anybody else. Luther let everything in. Zwingli's position was the position, finally, that of course the Restoration came about on. But then John Calvin dominated, of course, the second part of the Swiss Reformation. He was born in 1509 in France. He was from a middle-class family. He studied theology and law in Paris and became interested in Luther's teaching. And about 1533, he had what he called a conversion, and he, of course, deserted the Roman Catholic Church, deserted Catholicism, and went with the Reform. In 1533, he was arrested as a reformer in France, but was able to escape to Switzerland, and finally taking his abode up in Geneva. And in 1559, Calvin founded the University of Geneva, which became the leading theological school of Europe. And its graduates went to Scotland and Germany and Italy. And so Calvinism began to spread far and wide until it dominated the Protestant thinking of Europe. It still dominates the Protestant thinking of America and Europe. There's no man probably in the Reformation who has had a greater impact on the denominational world than John Calvin. And you know, today we talk about this grace, unity, and the problems we're facing right now in the church. It all goes back to Calvin. His doctrine will cause untold millions to go to hell, but it is a popular doctrine. His doctrine, he developed a five-point program to explain the salvation of man from sin. Now, his five-point program can be remembered by the word TULIP. T-U-L-I-P, he set forth the doctrine this way. And let me go over it. We won't have time to go into it. But his first point was total inherited depravity. In other words, he's born into the world totally depraved. His second point was unconditional election, the direct operation of the Spirit. If you were among the elect, nothing you could do about it. The Spirit would come and save you. The third point was limited atonement. If God had elected a certain group, and that group was fixed, then the only people Jesus atoned for were the elected. His fourth point was irresistible grace. And as we pointed out, the Spirit would come and save a man, and, you know, there's nothing you could do about it. It's just irresistible. And then the fifth point, the perseverance of the saints, or we know it as impossibility of apostasy. In other words, once saved, always saved. Now, this comes from Calvin. Now, John Knox was born in Scotland in 1505, and he was a convert to Protestantism by 1542. And Knox now became acquainted with Calvin in Geneva, and he returned to Scotland as a zealous reformer. And he introduced these 5 points of Calvinism in Scotland in I got my figures wrong, so I'll just go on. I won't give you the date, Dad, but this is what he did. Knox, he drew up the Articles of the Presbyterian Church. You want to know who started Presbyterianism? It was Knox. And so it was Knox that organized and, as we have stated, and founded what we know as the Presbyterian Church. So Presbyterianism grew from the teaching of Calvin, which was later, of course, advocated by Knox. Now, the Reformation in England, it began with Henry VIII, his quarrel with Pope Clement VII over the right to divorce Catherine and marry Anne Boleyn, an attendant of his wife Catherine. Now, his father, Henry VII, he had engaged Henry VIII's brother, Arthur, to Catherine. And she was, of course, the daughter of Fernando and Isabella of Spain. Now, this all came about because he was going to get a big dowry and also the alliance that would come about with Spain. That's the reason he wanted Arthur to marry her. But Arthur died in 1502, and shortly after this, shortly after, of course, his marriage to Catherine is what I want to say, but part of the dowry hadn't been paid. So you can see, Henry VII wanted that money. And so he had Henry VIII to marry Catherine. Now, he had to get a dispensation from the Roman Catholic Church for this to come about, because the Roman Catholic Church forbid a man to marry his brother's wife if he dies. And so he got this dispensation so Henry VIII could marry Catherine, and they had six children, and only one, Mary, survived. Now, Henry VIII, he wanted a male heir. So he went to Pope Clement the seventh, and he wanted him to revoke the dispensation which had allowed him to marry Catherine so he could marry Anne Boleyn. And this was 1527 at this time that this occurred. Now the Pope, they of course are political figures. Henry VIII, if you'll go back in history, you'll find that he had been a great defender of the Pope against the Reformation, you see. He had even defended, whenever Luther came out with his, the second pamphlet I mentioned, when he talked about the sacraments, Henry VIII had written a rebuttal to. And so he was known as a defender of the faith. But, and the Pope no doubt would have liked to have allowed him to have married Anne Boleyn. But, as I say, there was politics involved, because there was pressure on by Charles V. He was the most powerful monarch in Europe, and he was the nephew of Catherine. And he wasn't going to allow Henry VIII to do his ain't any such way. And he had laid the law down to the Pope. And so you can see why the Pope backed off of this. Well, now, Henry VIII, he intended to go on with his intention. He intended to marry Anne Boleyn, and he broke with the Catholic Church and married Anne Boleyn. And he had the Parliament then to pass the Act of Supremacy in 1534 and made him the head of the Church of England. Cut the Pope off and the money and everything that flowed that way. And so the Church of England had its beginning. And of course, it is known in America as the Episcopalian Church. That's the Church of England. Hurriedly, let me give you a little glimpse of the Methodist, and that'll wind up this. The Methodist movement, it was an outgrowth that of Charles and John Wesley and friends on the campus of the Oxford University from 1727 to 1729. They formed a group that they called the Holy Club. And John Wesley, he taught this group his methodical ways of study and work. And they began to be called Methodists by their enemies and their friends that just made fun of them. They called them Methodists. And so you see, they really took this name by derision. They considered themselves, of course, part of the Church of England. They were simply trying to bring about reform. But the Church of England objected to the doctrines and practices of these people, and they soon excluded the leaders from the pulpits of the Church of England, and so they were compelled to hold their services outdoors in private homes and barns and public halls. And so their members grew, and as their members grew, they formed what was known as Methodist societies throughout England. Then the complete organization of the Methodist Church came about in about 1744, somewhere along there, the Wesleys, they met with their workers in an annual conference. And so it was not until, though, 1795 that they completely separated from the Church of England. As a result of the Revolutionary War in this country, the Methodist Church in America broke all connections with the mother country and, of course, became independent. And so I found this statement that Methodism was founded in 1738 by John Wesley, and it was a quotation, and is 200 years old, and church people all over the world are celebrating the anniversary. This was a quotation out of the Christian Advocate, June the 17th, 1938. This was on the front page. But all I'm trying to say, it seems that some would set the beginning at about 1738 of the actual beginning. But it really started back in about 1729, along in there, when they were meeting and started these societies. And then it was a thing that progressed and developed. And it would be interesting just to go on into the denominations as they develop, but we won't have time. And we will pick up with the Restoration and spend the rest of our time in the Restoration movement. Next week we'll begin with the Restoration. No doubt I'll start out by talking about the Restoration principle as laid down in the Word of God. Now, before we close, do you have any questions or comments?